You're going here. All right. Thank you so much, Lynn, and thank you, Jay. And tonight we have a special guest. His name is Bob Ferguson, and you may have heard Bob because I play him. I've been playing him on an interview that he did with Renata McNay, and I'm not sure if it was last year or year before. Anyway, Adele sent the recording to me, and I listened to it, and I was pretty excited, and I just really wanted to meet this guy, and found out that he actually lives here in Colorado, which is even cooler. So anyway, I'm very excited to introduce Bob. Bob is the author of a book called The Listening Attention, and that book is available on Amazon. I do have it. I went and got it and downloaded it on my Kindle, so you can actually get it in a physical copy or in a Kindle as well. And Bob is a member of something called the TAT Foundation, and so I'm going to be asking Bob a little bit about this TAT, what it is and what it means. Warning you, Bob, and I'll be asking this stuff. And just want to talk to him. He's had a deep awakening. I'm quite convinced of that from listening to him on the recording. And so I'm just pleased and excited to have Bob here. So welcome, Bob, and I'm going to turn over the mic to you and let you say hello.
Hello, Lynn. How are you doing today? It's really good to be here. I'm sitting here with Phil here in Fruta, and it's really nice to be able to talk to you guys this afternoon and get to talk to you a little bit about the TAT Foundation and the Listening Attention.
All right, and I also wanted to thank Phil Frisk for being here to help our guest. It's not very often that we have a guest who we have someone who's pretty expert in dealing with PAL talk issues, hopefully, to help him out. So it's a wonderful thing. So Bob, I'm not going to ask you to tell me your life story. This is not what I'm interested in any way at all. Also, people in the audience are welcome to ask questions if they'd like. You can type a question on the board, or you can put up your hand if you'd like and ask a question after we've talked a little bit. Bob, I'm not going to ask you your, life story or tell me how you came to find this and that and the other thing. But I would like to know a little bit about the TAT Foundation. I found it quite interesting, when I went and looked at the, website. And, if you wouldn't mind talking about TAT and your maybe relationship with, Richard Rose and, just in general, whatever you like to tell us. So I'm turning the mic back over to you, Bob, and thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you, Lynn. Yes, Richard Rose was a teacher I studied with at his home, his ashram there in West Virginia near Wheeling. And he founded the TAT Foundation in about 1972, maybe, around in there. And the TAT Foundation stands for Truth and Transmission. And he started this foundation because he found that he had a hard time working with other enlightened men and women, and he wanted to have a foundation where they could get together, where people from different paths who had found things in a different way together and have a common ground. He started it as a nonprofit and had 4 meetings a year, which we still have. We used to have him on his farm there in West Virginia. Now we have him at the Claymont Mansion, which is outside of D.C., and at Penn Scenic View, which is in Pennsylvania. There's one coming up in about 2 weeks. He started this in the 70s, and we've been continuing it ever since. When he passed away about 15 years ago or so, we took over the TAT Foundation and are still having the meetings. We have one in April, one around July 4th, another one in September, and another one after Thanksgiving about. Now, Richard Rose was a strange man in a way that he had a certain sense of charisma or power to him. It was very impressive. I first met him when he gave a talk in Boulder, and I saw an ad or a blurb for it in the Rocky Mountain News. I was up in Granby, and at the time wasn't really interested in this kind of work. But I saw his photograph in the Rocky Mountain News, and something about it grabbed me. And I thought, I've got to write this guy and see what this guy is up to. I wrote him a letter, and he wrote back on the handwritten stationery, which really surprised me. He wrote me back, and it's something about it grabbed me, and I said, I've got to go meet him. So sooner or later, it took me 3 or 4 years, I think, before I got around to it, went to see him at his farm there in West Virginia at one of his meetings. And the man really had something. I knew that as soon as I sat in a room with him, that he knew more about me in that few minutes together than I knew about myself, which was quite unnerving at the time. So I thought to myself, I've got to find out what this guy's got. I knew that whatever he had, if I could see it in him, then I must have a glimpse of it in myself too, or I wouldn't recognize it. So I started going to TAT meetings, went to them for quite a while, for 3 or 4 years before I decided that I had to move there and try to spend time with Richard Rose over as much as I could. He was getting up in years then. I knew he didn't have much time left. So I moved there to his ashram in West Virginia and spent about 2 years with him and studying with the other fellows in the TAT Foundation. There's still quite a good-sized group. We even have our own publishing arm where we put out books that several of us have written. And Mr. Rose had a experience when he was young, but this was back in the 40s, so he didn't really have a whole lot of people to talk with it about. So he tried to communicate this through another channel, and he thought Zen was the best form that was out at the time that he could get this kind of thing out and make it a little more mainstream so people could get some kind of a handle on it. Back at in these times, this was quite an unusual thing. Not too many people were around back then. I think you had Uspensky and Gurdjieff, some of these guys, when Rose was around. By the time he got into the 70s, he got a pretty good group going. Because at that time the hippies were around. So he had quite a few people showing up on his farm interested in O. Castaneda and Alan Watts. He spent a good bit of time trying to get these guys, on a straight and narrow, Zen type of path. When I first met Rose there, the guy had that sense of power to him. He had something he liked to call a rapport. We would sit in a room together and where we were quiet, and something that Rose could do he called direct mind. Sooner or later there would be some sort of a feeling that would come through the room to where everybody became of one mind, that he would kind of direct this. And when he would do this, it would leave you with a feeling of having no thoughts and of everybody being the same. There was just one awareness in the room. I had never felt anything like this. It was very direct and had nothing to do with thinking and had nothing to do with anything I'd studied. It grabbed me, and I thought, I've got to figure out what he is talking about. How does he do this? How does this happen to us? There would also be a feeling at the meetings that after a while you would have a silence and a kind of a peace about you that would last for several days. I've heard people say that this would happen to them when they would visit Ramana Maharshi at his ashram there at Arunachala in India. When I would leave Rose's farm, It would hang around for 2 or 3 days. Then it eventually would die back out, and the mind would become cluttered again. I thought, how do I get this for myself? So I asked Rose about it and said, how can I have this without having to be around you? And he would usually give practical advice, which sometimes could be kind of tricky in his Zen way. And he told me, the way that you can have that feeling all the time is to get your own group. If you go out there and get a group together around you and you guys start working together in a commonality to find this for yourselves, you'll have it all the time. Years went by, I found that this was true. But it was also a tricky thing he would use to try and keep people active. He loved to play little Zen tricks on us on the farm. A lot of times, anything that would go wrong, pretty soon we would think that Rose was playing some sort of trick on us. As he got to be older, when he started getting Alzheimer's later on, sometimes we couldn't differentiate between who is actually playing a trick on us or is this actually the Alzheimer's getting to us. It got to be kind of funny after a while. When we had the meetings there with him on the farm, we had quite a nice group of us. There's still quite a few who are writing books right now. We've got a fellow who was here in Fruta now, Art Tickner, who has written a book called The Solid Ground of Being and also one called Beyond Relativity. But Rose used to call what we call, I think a lot of people call now, oneness. He called this the absolute in his terminology. He told us that what has happened to us when we form a personality from the world, we lose our direct mind capability when we're quite young. And he thought that the way back to this was to pick up strings back to the absolute, to get back to that oneness that is the commonality beneath us all. He was very more psychologically oriented in terms of thinking that the experiences that have happened to us have formed this strange thing called an experiencer. And we've become identified with this experiencer as being the me, that I am that, I am this experiencer, which is actually just an after-the-fact group of experiences. He felt that there was a direct way of getting back to this, to the real part of ourselves that was there out of time in eternity before this experiencer that we say me to. I found after studying with Rose, after I had an experience of my own back in approximately 2000, I started calling this direct mind the listening attention. For me, it's an attention that one has that is directly related to what one is perceiving and isn't filtered through the me or the ego, through the experiencer. And this attention is passive in a sense because it doesn't judge, it doesn't qualify, it has nothing that's placed on to what you're seeing. You see things directly through this. And with the listening attention, I found that this is what I call the gateway to within. I found that from the listening attention, if you get into a period where you're directly perceiving without the experiencer, it's almost as if the things that you're perceiving are almost talking to you as you look around. You don't have things that are coming through the experiencer mind through time. Yes, that's a nice quote that Sweet Dreams has put up here on the board. Through this listening attention, I found that I could gain a pathway into what you might call the inner self. Rose used to say sometimes that he was two people, that he was an outer self and the inner self. And the outer self, what I call the little man, is that experiencer. And this experiencer is the part of us that isn't real. It's the ego, the part that dies, because it's not real. Once you've gotten behind that little man, you could into the part that Rose would call the absolute, or I would call the the inner self, which is the part that doesn't say I to itself. It doesn't have a sense of that. When I had my experience, one of the emotional parts of it was that I found that for the first time in my life, I was in a place or I was something that had no concern. I called it the place of no concern. Because since there was no front, back, up, down, side to side to it, no duality, there was nothing to be concerned about and nobody to be concerned. It had a funny way of talking about it. I thought at the time that one of the best ways to describe it was that everything was in the same place at the same time. So that if that's the case, then there's nothing really happening. So there was nothing to be concerned about. The emotional release of that was quite phenomenal. Because there was no more any of the sense of anxiety that I had always had, which came from being identified with something which isn't real. I think a lot of us have that innate sense of anxiety or nervousness because we've identified ourselves with the fake part of us. How do you get past that into something which is real and connect with it and therefore get around the nervousness of a false identification? When this happened to me too, that I also saw that eternity and things like infinity aren't just concepts, and there's nothing that you have to go to. They're right here, right now. If they weren't, then they wouldn't be eternal, and they wouldn't be infinite. So it was very practical to me. I couldn't no longer get into this being a complicated path. It was the simplest thing you could do. But because of it being so simple, we just don't look for it. One of the fellows in the Tat Foundation makes documentary films, and he made one about one of our some of our members. There's a member in Raleigh, North Carolina, Bart Marshall, who has a group down there called the Self Inquiry Group, or SIG, S-I-G. Him and his wife Deborah Westmoreland give retreats down there, and these fellows were in Sean's documentary that he made, and he called the name of this documentary Closer Than Close, just to show how close our real self is. That it's something that we think we have to go to, and we have to find that it's outside of ourselves. But actually, it's the most simplest thing that there is, and it's the closer than anything we can think of. It's primary to our thinking. When I would talk about the listening attention as it being is an ever-present something which is like a baseline of awareness, this awareness is right there with us all the time, so we don't really have to look for it. But it's hard to see that because of the way the mind works. We're taught how to believe in our projection system. For me, this came about as a being able to describe it as a gap in time. We were lost in time, so there's a gap between us and the eternality that we are. And this happens because of the mind's ability to project. Rose used to tell us that the mind was much better at creating than it is at witnessing. And you can see this by our ability to project and create and then believe in our own projections. We'll see something outside of ourselves, we'll judge it, put a name on it that we've learned, and this all happens unconsciously, and then we end up projecting this back into our mind and only see the finished projection. So there's always a little bit of a gap in time there between what we're seeing and thinking about, between what our actual perception is. There's a scientists have actually proven this by showing that there's a small gap between what when the arm, say, wants to raise and when we say we're going to raise our arm. There's actually a measurable gap between there. So we're lost in this after-the-fact creation, this personality. and forgotten where we are in the eternality. Rosa told us about how he had done dream work too. I did dream work as my first path or first study that I did. And when I looked at my dreams, I saw what Rose had said, that they were can be a first step into our own mind, so we can start seeing how our mind works. He also noticed that there were three basic moods in the dream world, which we have in the in our waking world too. He called these three moods, which I found to be quite valid, because I was very much went at this work from a feeling position rather than from a thinking position. And he said we have fear and seduction, which are the two main moods in our mind, and fear being backing away from things, and seduction or acquisition or wanting or desire is being going toward things. Those two are useless because that's what the ego does. The ego wants to be either superior or inferior, is lost in duality. But the third one, he said was useful, is nostalgia. But not nostalgia in the sense of sentimentality. I say it's not the somebody wanting to sit on the front porch in a root beer commercial with the grandkids, but it's more along the lines of longing, in terms of what Rumi talks about. This longing for our true home. I think that all of us have this feeling function to figure out this longing and this nostalgia. If you look at how nostalgia can help, I like to look at it from saying from guilt. If you look at guilt and break it down, you can see the guilt is made up of nostalgia and fear. It's fear because we're fear of whatever we're guilty about, that we're going to be punished for it. And then we're nostalgic because we'd like to get back to the innocent state we were before we committed the act which made us guilty. Now, what might that innocent state be if you look at this from the point of view of the work or the path? That innocent state is a listening attention, or we were as we were children. If you look back and think of where was I when I was an innocent baby, did I have anything that I needed? I was completely taken care of. I was complete. There was nothing that I had to want. Everything was me. Nostalgia can point back to this innocence, the innocence feeling that we were before we became a person and before we got lost in time and the world. I had to go about this from a feeling function, which is different from some of the guys that were in TAT that I studied with that were more of on the thinking function. And we used to have a problem talking together, too, because I could not understand how to reason. It was only after my experience that I saw that reason was a valid way to go about this. But for me, the nostalgia and the moods and the longing were the way to do this. And I got a good bit of this from the dream work and working with Rose about with the dreams. One way that I've seen too that has to be to work at this work is the enormous emotional connection that we make with the person that we think we are. It's very hard for us to go against that. The ego has an ability to split itself into pieces. There's a fellow that Rose worked with who was a Zen master in New York back in the 40s. His name was Alfred Pulgan. He talked about the ego splitting itself into pieces as ego one, ego two. It's very slippery. So ego one can say, oh, I see that ego over there, and I'm going to destroy that ego and get rid of it. This is simply the ego tricking itself into thinking it's going to destroy this thing it just made up, which it calls ego. It's hard to get at this when it's tricky, because we can always keep running around in a circle chasing our tail, thinking we're getting rid of our ego. For me, this never worked until it became emotional. The way it became emotional for me that happened to me was I had placed all my faith in my teacher, Richard Rose, and Richard Rose one day told me that I had to leave and get away from the farm. He kicked me off the farm, the ashram, told me to get out. That was emotionally devastating for me, and I had no idea what to go, what to do. And it broke the hold that the emotional part of the ego came on me. And all of a sudden, I realized that there was a part of me that was universal. Yes, I see somebody says they call ego one, ego two as thing one, thing two. But it broke the emotional hold, which I found is very hard to talk about. It's very easy to get into these things with in a very conceptual sense. But when it gets down to realizing that it's me we're talking about, it almost takes some sort of part of ourselves, or that you might call a teacher, which actually comes to be a part of yourself, that can see you from the outside and help you with this. I realized that Richard Rose had done that for me. He had been a part that realized what he could see, how I was attached to myself, and could play a trick on me in order to get me into what you might call a traumatic situation. So that it would knock that ego's emotional element out from under itself. It was kind of strange too, because for me, when I finally had the experience, I had the awareness, seeing part of the experience happen before the emotional part happened, which was hard to talk about too, because all of a sudden I was not myself anymore. But it seemed just interesting at the time. I had no idea what had really happened, except that I was somehow became everything, and that I was just aware of that. And I was aware of this strange little creature running around out there called Bob. But it didn't really bother me for a few weeks. The emotional side of it came later on, which I would say is pretty much like a death experience for the emotional part to finally having that. It's easy to talk about realization or enlightenment, but it's hard when the actual part of yourself finally lets go and dies. And yes, I see on here it says, yes, did you grieve? I did. And I grieved in a sense that I felt sorry for the Bob thing, for the little man. I've written a couple of poems about that too, showing how the Bob character, I felt sorry for him because he was very much in love with himself. He was in love with his world. And that was all gone. He was in love with an illusion, being an illusion. So it was very sad to see how we get lost into these emotional traps of this. I'm going to read you a little bit about that. I can pull it up here. I used to call him the little man. I've got a poem called that, The Little Man. From early morning coffee to late night herbal tea, we lived for near forever, the little man and me. When first I came to travel in this classroom wide and grand, I knew nothing of the coming of this lonely little man. But parents, teachers, doctors, the whole damn helping herd, soon created him inside me, as their ancestors had ensured. He has no real existence, none that I can see, but could and should and would scream that little man in me. Soon I hid myself in pride, found that fear blocked every door. I was now what I despised, just as those had gone before. The hypnosis worked its magic. No peace had I, no stand, just a misidentification. I became the little man. I took him for a person. Hell, I thought, he was me. He sure could be convincing, that little man and me. And then one day it happened. I know not really why. I looked out there below me from some great eternal sky. He didn't even notice, so busy as a bee. He just kept right on sleeping. But that little man ain't me. One day, looking in the mirror, from my bed as I did stand, I receded back behind him, that sleeping little man. He didn't even notice, just a grain lost in the sand. He can't look back and see me, that lonely little man. I watch him and his pattern, how he blends right in so well, that his life and his surroundings are no different from himself. He has no greater vision. Desire and fear are all he sees. An actor in the TV, that little man in me. It's a sad but true short story. I cry a tear, and so does he. He won't survive. He lives to die, that little man in me. Yes, that's right. Somebody says here that when you believe you are the little man, you've abdicated your authority and the power of your own mind. You have. That's what created the anxiety in me. I went through years of trying to see how to get rid of that anxiety. Lots of things worked for short periods of time. Distractions, alcohol, drugs, different systems of meditation. But nothing would get down to the bottom of it, which is that misidentification, which is finding out that you've become that experiencer. And it's such a tricky thing. There's a fellow, Jim Burns, who lives in Pittsburgh now, and Richard Rose met him when him and Jim were back in the 80s, and Rose thought he had a very clear case of enlightenment. And Rose very seldom thought, very few people did. But the strange thing was is that Jim spent most of his life in mental institutions. And he said the strange thing was I was only the only person in the institutions who knew he was crazy. I knew this quite well. He said most of the people had no idea. But Jim would say that the way that we have to break this identification is to start to see who this little man is. He would give an example. Say if you're there's two people walking down the street. Now they're seeing the same things. It's the same physical world the two of them are walking down, but each person will see different things. Why is your mind drawn to the things you see instead of the things the other person is seeing? This is how we get individualized. And Jim would say that if you can see how these things work, you'll start to notice that what he would call the inner self is always throwing balls over the fence, he would say. It's like it's always trying to throw a tennis ball over the fence and hit you in the head with it and say, hey, buddy, look up. You know, what's going through your head right now and why? He would say that whatever you need to know about yourself, you don't have to go back into the past to find these things, like an analysis, that they're always there in the current of the moment, right now. You can stay in the moment. You can see what your mind is trying to show you about yourself, how you can see what it is it's trying to get you to look at, so that you can see how you keep yourself asleep. What is it about yourself that you need to see? I was in an online group right when the internet got started, and we were trying to do self-inquiry online. And it was really helpful at the time. There's a couple of the guys that had experiences and were very good at confronting some of us who were on this online inquiry group. One of them was able to point out to me at a certain time, right when I was ripe for it, how I was in love with myself. Now, this is a very common thing. We all do this. But he pointed it out to me in a way that I saw, oh my gosh, I am in love with this Bob thing. And it's a very real, present time love, and all of my time is spent in one way or another keeping that love alive. That if I could let go of that, the whole thing might collapse. So things like what you guys are doing here on the internet with this PAL talk could be really helpful in that kind of sense. If it wouldn't have been for that confrontation group online and somebody pointing out what my hook was emotionally at a certain time, how I was in love with myself, I could have gone on maybe possibly for more years being lost in that. I'm going to ask Lynn right now if she's got any other questions or if she wants to say anything at this point.
All right. Yeah. Thank you, Bob. This is really good. This is really, really good. Because this is really getting to the core of, yes, a lot of what we talk about here. And one thing that I appreciated when I was reading about the TAP Foundation and reading about what was you had been doing is that so many of these teachers really impress upon you to like it's a singular thing, it's a self thing, I'm going within. But I found very useful, and it sounds to me like you have too, the interaction with each other. And that's one thing, A Course in Miracles, which I don't know if you're familiar with A Course in Miracles, but that is one thing in A Course in Miracles is pretty adamant, is about it's the relationship with our brothers that wakes us up. It really is the relationship with our brother and being able to see what we call the Christ, the truth, the reality of a person, to see that in a person behind that little man, beyond the ego, beyond the false sense of self, to be able to join with each other in that place where we all are in that one place, and that what I'm considering you're calling the listening attention. So I'm finding that really fascinating. And I see that Jay has his hand up. So Jay, I'm going to let you have the mic if you want to ask a question or make a statement.
Yeah, I wanted to say thank you very much, Bob, for coming. I appreciated hearing your talk a great deal. And the TAP Foundation sounds like a wonderful organization. And I guess I realized I had heard of it before, but I just hadn't actually investigated it. My question for you is, when you spoke about the love affair you realized that you had with that false persona called Bob, could you share in your journey your process of either ending that love affair, or did you have like a sudden awakening at some point, or what was your sort of next stage in that process of your own awakening with that false persona in your own journey? So that's what my question is. Okay, giving it the mic.
Oh, thanks, Jay. Yeah, the love was the self-love that I think before realization we're all trapped into is very unconscious, but very very all-encompassing. What happened to me was because of group work and because of having a group to work with, it was pointed out to me. Otherwise, I think you can spin around in circles with yourself and never get rid of it. The realization that I had after I was confronted in a online group with this, and somebody was able to point out to me in detail how my self-love was functioning in the group to where, in a manner that I couldn't escape it. He backed me into a corner. And so that got me into a position where I couldn't get away from it anymore. It just, it wouldn't leave me alone. And I saw it in a sense that it was so devastating that it led to what you might call a trauma. And the trauma broke the bubble of that emotional love. It was very devastating. It knocked me down in a sense, and it was quite a bit. Yes, somebody asked up here, Jay, I see that you asked, the trauma of being asked to leave the ashram was about a couple of years before the trauma from the self-love. That pretty much got me out of being in love with the guru. At that time, I thought Rose was going to do it for me. I thought he was the key. When he left and he kicked me out of the ashram, I realized I was on my own. I had to find it inside of myself, which is where it lies. It doesn't lie out with a teacher. Then later on, the self-love was the love with of the ego being in love with itself. When the trauma of that happened, at first, like I mentioned before, it happened in a very awareness sense. I became aware of myself as being behind myself in a strange sense. It was a different way of looking. I became something. Rose had always says, you do not learn, you only can become. And I knew what he meant, and I also knew that there was no way the ego could do this to itself. There's no way for the ego to get back at what we really are. It has to somehow happen almost like an accident. Bart Marshall says that the only chance we have is to up the probability that we'll have that accident. After I had become this awareness, a few days later, I had the emotional trauma. And the emotional trauma was that, I don't know how to describe it, I guess you would say it's a death experience. That it became very devastating. I was out cross-country skiing at the time when it happened, and I became everything that is aware. If there's something that's looking out through anybody's eyes, that's what it was. I was that. That's looking out through anyone's eyes, it's only one thing. In other words, there's only one awareness, and it looks out through the others. It's hard to describe that. I've had people ask me, well, do you have a multiplistic view when you're looking out through everybody's eyes? And it's like, no, it's not that kind of experience, but it was very, very devastating to the emotional side of me. It was the death of everything that I thought was going to happen to me. It was the death of the human being. I became to see that I wasn't anything I thought was human. I had thought that becoming awakened was going to make me more loving or more conscious or these kinds of human-described emotions or characteristics, but what I became was more of a awareness which had a feeling of not being a human individualized thing. And that was very devastating to the ego life sense. It just knocked it right out the window. It actually, I ended up down in the snow on top of the skis, passed out from it. Rose used to say that if a true awakening, they have to carry you out on a stretcher. That's what happened to him. I think he said this because he used to tell us that the mind is perfectly capable of manufacturing an experience for us so that we don't have to really go through one. If we want one bad enough, we can create one, which means we've created a cop-out. So he said the sign of if you're having a real experience is that it hits you emotionally, that it's not what you thought it was going to be. I had no idea that this what was happening to me was it. I always thought that I would be asserted, that I would become very powerful and more individualistic. I'd be able to read minds and travel out of the body, these kinds of things, which was always still an individualistic sense that just becomes much greater. It's like almost like you're going to get so big that you're going to push God out of the way. Yes, it's magical thinking. Somebody says magic stuff on here. But what happens is you just lose the basic individuality sense. You don't pump it up anymore. You also have to pump it up in a sense, because if you don't have a practical ego, you can't lose it. Now, that's a funny thing, and I realized, too, that there was something to that. I think we have to have some sort of practical ego in order to get the body mind into a position to where it can lose itself. Otherwise, it tends to wander off into fantasy. In other words, we have to know the difference between fantasizing about realization and having it actually happen to us. That losing the love sense also, Rose used to say that you have to lose little L love in order to become big L love. And I knew what he meant, because once you've lost that self-love, then love, as it is, can come through you. It's the being emptied. Love or isness has no place in us as long as we're full of ourselves. You know, as long as we're full of ego, there's no room for anything else. But to become empty is very it's death. There's no other way for it to happen. Yes, I see grandiosity comes up on here, and I was in AA for quite a while, and grandiosity is a good way to put that. The ego sense just keeps thinking it's going to be bigger and bigger. And losing that is a very good way to talk about it. One thing I've seen, that to fight that self-love, for me, it had to be done in a group. And I think what I see now, that the reason for that is, I see this in a lot of with the internet out, a lot of the guys who are in the little group we have in Denver now, is that they can bounce around on the internet from YouTube video to teacher to different websites, and they can keep doing this in a circle forever and ever, comparing what this guy says to what that guy says, spinning around in a circle. But if you can get into a group where you have personal interaction and be honest with each other about this, you can steer each other back from being lost in these fantasies. You can call each other on it. This was very helpful in the groups that we have. We practice a form of a group inquiry where we question each other's thinking in order to get you to see how, like Jim Burns said, how does my mind work? How have I become individualized into a collection of experiences? And how is that always fooling me? How am I always getting fooled back into the circle of spinning around in the mind? The mind is a very strange thing. To get out of the mind, you can't do it with the mind. It has to happen from something on a greater level. The individual self, I think it was Einstein or one of these guys who said, you can't solve a problem from the level of the problem. I saw that very clearly once I became something that was beyond myself, that there was absolutely no way the ego could enlighten itself. It had to happen with some sort of help from something outside. There were very a multi-pronged approach, I think, is to do this. You can see with a group how you're fooling yourself, and if you have some other kind of method, can help you too. I talked about dream work earlier. Dream work to me was a way to get started in this. When I first got into a group inquiry, I couldn't do it because my ego was so sensitive that if I would be confronted on my thinking in the group, I would tend to just lock up. I couldn't handle it. The ego would just shut down and I'd go numb. I had to go about it sideways. The way I did this with dream work was through my dreams. I could see how my mind worked when it wasn't threatening. I could look at the dreams and see it and come at it sideways. There's a lot of ways you can do this, and you can do this with journaling. I've seen people do it that way. But it gets to get you to a sense of seeing, how do I fool myself? What pattern am I stuck in? I could not believe the effect of how what my parents and my upbringing had had, and I had never questioned that. Even though I had been in analysis and had been in therapy and in AA, it never struck home until I looked at my dreams and saw, oh my gosh, I am spinning around in my parents' thinking one against the other. The guy I was working in the dream work with told him, he said, whenever you write in your dreams about mother, you should capitalize the M in that. That's how much this is affecting you. And I thought, oh my gosh, it is. I bought into her way of thinking. Take it as mine and have never questioned it. Never knew how to get around behind myself. I think working in a group, especially face to face, I think can really help with this. And it also helps if you get into group work and you actually have to start doing something. It's very easy to be a taker in this work and receive and have people help you and teach you. You can read books, you can look at videos. But when are you going to get out there and start doing something? Are you going to help run a group? Are you going to help do something like what you guys have got going here on the internet? Are you going to get involved to where you're putting yourself on the line rather than sitting back in a safe place in yourself where you're not ever going to be called on this, where you might never have to make a mistake? I see that the ego always has to be right, somebody says, and can't stand to be mistaken. That's exactly it. The ego has to be right, even if it's being wrong. Some people will say, oh, well, I can't be right because I can't do anything right. I'm always a mess. Well, that's the ego being right. It's being right by being wrong. Yes, somebody put up the great saying that all are called, few choose to listen. When Richard Rose was a young child, he was sitting in school. He said he used to find himself writing on a piece of paper, many are called, few are chosen. He said this got this into his mind that to find out what the truth, he always put it in those words, what is the truth? He said to find the truth, he realized that what he had to do was start acting. He had to put himself on the line and not be afraid to make mistakes and find out what was going on out there. And so, you know, somebody saying here, and who am I? I hated it when Rose used to say, what is the truth? Because I couldn't understand what the word truth meant. All of a sudden that opened things up for me. I thought, what the heck does that mean? The truth. It finally led back around to something I helped a lot, which was self-honesty. How do we learn to be honest with ourselves? I learned that I could not be honest with myself because to do that did not keep that self-love I had afloat. To be honest would threaten that. It would threaten anything that I wanted to do. It would even get to the point where I would be editing my past in order to keep that storyline going. So that self-honesty is a big one, and with the truth, I hated the words of that, the truth, but it, sooner or later it comes down to that. Which, what is the truth? I'd like to see if Lynn's got anything to say or if there's anybody who's got a question at this point.
Gosh, this is awesome. Yeah. Jim Dunn said, Buddhists ask, who am I before I had a face? That whole idea of self-honesty, I'm just so taken by this, and I'm so taken by the idea of working with other people who are willing to not play nice with you and say, oh, what a great spiritual student you are and how wonderful you look at those nice baby steps you're taking. You know, I don't want to work with people who are doing that because, not because, you know, I don't enjoy it, and I'm certain that, you know, my ego is very happy being told what a great baby stepper I am, but to work with someone who is really going to question and not take for an answer something that is not 100% honest, Yeah, I need an ego buster, not an ego coddler. Exactly, Nikki. And it sounds to me like this is what Richard Rose was doing, and it sounds to me that's what you guys are doing as well. And I'm really, really excited to hear you talking about this. You know, I'm excited to know that there are groups, and that, you know, there's even a group in the Denver area where this kind of work is being done, because this really is the work that we are doing here. And it's coming to understand that this stuff is first off not being told. The divinity in me doesn't need to be told any of this stuff. It's only the ego that needs to be told this, and that's what I'm calling the Thing One and Thing Two. It, to me, is like the little Dr. Seuss characters, Thing One and Thing Two. The one ego that is the little worker bee that's, you know, just out thinking that it's small and independent and needs to protect itself and needs to take care of itself. And then there's the other, there's Thing Two that watches over Thing One basically and interprets what is being heard, because that ego to me is what hears the truth and is able to kind of interpret and trying to work with the other in order to let me go. You know, basically that's what I'm looking at, and maybe this may not be how you saw this, but for me, just to let me go and to not hold me or make me want to stay because I have to take care of you or something. Anyway, I'll give you back the mic, Bob. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks, Lynn. Yeah, I've seen some things here. People are saying that it's a paradox. Somebody says that brutal honesty doesn't have to be brutality. That's very true. You have to be able to use discernment in this. When you see that somebody's got an ego that might could be pointed out to them, it has to be done in a way. Like I said with dream work, it was a way that I could see things about myself to where it wouldn't be so threatening to the ego that it wouldn't just lock up and shut down. That it wouldn't just come through and knock everything down rather than having me come into a realization with it. And there's quite a bit of things that you can do in the group work that are just very simple. I know I was sitting in a room with Richard Rose one time, and at the time, I thought that I had all this down. I had done all the reading, I had been in lots of groups, and was just talking away with him, and he just turned around and looked at me and said, "You need to learn how to listen." That just floored me, because I realized that I had no idea how to listen. All I was doing was waiting for my turn to talk. And it just stopped my head. To find out what this thing is down inside of us, the listening attention, so to speak, is one of the Gurdjieff guys, Maurice Nicole, used to talk about his way of answering people when they would say, "What is self-remembering? What self are we trying to remember?" He would say, "You are trying to remember the self that knows its own nothingness." To me, this was very instrumental, because I figured I don't know a self that knows its own nothingness. I only know selves that know and know how to be right. But that self that knows its own nothingness is also the self that can't do. Rose used to say, "You are what you do until you know that you do nothing." And it's a very distinct stages we have to go through. I think we have to come to the point where we're a practical ego and we become that which we do, and we take responsibility for that so that we're self-honest. We realize that, yes, I have to be responsible for what I'm doing, for what I'm saying, then from that point, we can move on to the point where we realize we do nothing. Otherwise, we just get caught up in fantasy. He used to also say that you have to fatten the head before you chop it off. Which used to be to say, what the heck is he talking about? I'm not cutting my head off. But you have to become something before you can become nothing, I think was what he was talking about. It's like the Buddha saying, first think of everything, then think of nothing. If we want to become nothingness, we first got to become a little more of somethingness. I had a dream about this one time, that what I was doing was simply adding another head onto the top of the one that I already had. I wasn't getting rid of my head. I wasn't chopping off my head. I was just adding another one, a spiritual head. I had a dream that said, there was a drawing in the dream, and it was a guy with a head with another head growing out of the top of that one. And the name of the dream was Double Head Head. I realized I had to not only chop off the one I was growing, but I hadn't even gotten down to even looking at the one that had been there in the first place, that I had been building up since sometime around when I was a kid. It's funny too, when to get into this thing with the to get back to the nostalgia part, I learned that there was a part of me that was a long time ago had known a lot about this but didn't have the words for it, and knew how to connect back with a direct mind. When you're a kid, you can pick up on things like this because you don't have the teaching and the experiences and the judgment to interfere with it. I grew up hanging out in mental hospitals because my mother was a mental health administrator. So I would spend a lot of time when I was a kid around psychiatrists. Back then, when I still had a direct mind ability, being a little kid, I knew that these guys were crazy, which was really funny, that the psychiatrists weren't dangerous crazy, but I knew that these guys somehow didn't know what they were doing. I knew that when I was a little kid. When I got to be an adult and went to college in psychology, I realized that had been a very astute intuition at the time. So the little kids know this. They have that ability, and I can tell you a story in a little bit about how I got back to that through photography. I see that somebody says, when you had your realization, did you know you had it all along? Yes. When you get back behind yourself, when you become, you know that you've been there all along. You've never really left. You just became confused and identified with the false part of yourself. It's a funny thing. You realize that you've never moved. You've never gone anywhere. You've never been in anything but what you've ever been. When I was a little kid, I could look outside and see beauty in a direct sense. The beauty was there, and I had no thoughts about it. The beauty I knew was in me. I lost this as I got older, but I remembered when I was a kid, I wanted to show my parents the beauty that I could see outside. Just as a little kid, I wanted to share it with them. So I got a little brownie box camera, and I took it out and took pictures, and I was going to show my parents this wonderful beauty I could see. And of course, all it was just sticks and trees. And I was really disappointed that it didn't work. But I got to be an adult, and I could, after the realization, I realized that beauty was in me again. Rose used to take people to the ocean to see the sunrise because he thought he could show them the trick. If you see the sun coming up, and that beautiful sunrise comes up, and it just renders you speechless, he could show people how that beauty is not in the sunrise. The beauty is in you. And you are seeing it in the sunrise because we are taught that we can't have those things in us. They're in the outside world. Enlightenment's out there somewhere, on a website or something. But it's inside us, and we've forgotten about it. The beauty we project onto a scene, because the scene that we've been taught allows us to project that beauty. It's a way that society has told us the only way we can see it. And the same thing with realization, with eternity, with ourselves as what we are. It's in us. We've just been taught that it's not. How can we find our way back to that? To me, this was what nostalgia was such a great thing. You could find that longing and find your way back into that, which is inside. It's in our heart, so to speak. And it comes out of ourselves. And earlier I was talking about getting rid of ourselves in order to let love come through. Anything that we want is inside of us. We can have it. If you want bliss, then bliss is there. If you want to know what you are, then you can do that. But how do you get back to those things? That's one of the way this work is all about. Like I said, for me, this has always been a feeling thing. Rose used to say that the highest value is not in IQ, it's in intuition. And he said, what is intuition? Well, intuition is developed feeling. It's developing the feeling sense to where we can feel our way back. He used to say that the smartest person might not be able to do this work very well because they're in love with their intellect to the point that they can never think that they could ever learn anything. But a person who's not very smart knows he can be tricked. So he might be more cautious and know that he needs that intuition. I've seen people that are very, very intelligent who have a hard time with this because they're always able to feel their way, not able to feel their way. They get caught up in the concepts. That's true, I think what Jim is saying here, that we have to at some point realize that the seeking is the problem. Do you want to be a seeker or do you want to find? I had the guy who taught me dream work used to tell jokes about this. He used to say, everybody wants to get better, but nobody wants to get well. He used to make a joke about the Monty Python movie where the huge fat guy was eating, and he kept eating and eating until he blew up, and the waiter kept saying, would you like a little more to eat? Do you feel better? And the guy would say, yeah, I feel better. Better get a bucket. Yeah, way for thin men. I see that Jerry knows what I'm talking about here. So, well, nobody wants to finally get well. They just want to keep getting better and better all the time. To be improved. You know, to be a better me. You know, when are you going to give up the role of seeking? But we become identified with that. We become hooked into it. It's just another distraction. You know, and plus, what are you going to do? A friend of mine I talked about earlier who makes spiritual documentaries, he's got a wonderful website called Poetry in Motion. He's a wonderful poet. It reminds me of Rumi quite a bit. But he said that after he had his realization, he felt like he was unemployed. And he said, all of a sudden, I have nothing to do. I have no more seeking. There's nothing that I have to do anymore. He said it became almost like I get up in the morning and I don't have to do this seeking thing. You like the Eggo frozen waffles there, aren't you? Yes, I went through that too. It became a point of, well, what do I do now? You know, what do I do? Rosa used to say that he used to recommend to people to find out who you are first before you get hung up in life. He thought we should do this work when we're fairly young, before we get tied down. He said, if you find out who you are and you come back and you still have an interest in cabbages and kings, then you can go ahead and play the games. But find out who you are first. Then if you want to come back and play games, then fine. He himself came back and had a family, had two families in a row. In fact, and plus started a group. So he came back and felt that a person who is a seeker or in this work at all, even after realization, should be practical. When he married his first wife, he went around to find a preacher, and he wanted to find a preacher who had calloused hands so he could see that the preacher actually worked for a living. He was really down on eating from the altar. He didn't like to make money from this. He never made money from it at all. He lived very, very poorly, almost to the point of view of some of us, our detriment. When we used to live on the ashram, we heated with wood. It was almost like third world conditions, but he would even begrudge us to be able to put a log on the fire. Because he was very big on saving energy, saving money, not spending anything unless you had to. He wanted to stay as far out of being entrapped in this dimension, as he said, as you can. He used to say, too, he said, you guys had better get on the stick and find out who you are, because when I die, I'm not coming back here to help you. He said, I've had enough of this place, so don't think I'm going to come back here floating around in a cloud over your head helping you. And he said, I'm gone. I'm getting out of here. He had a wonderful sense of humor. I've never met anybody who could make people laugh like that. He could get us in a room and have you, everybody in stitches with those belly laughs that just hurt. And he had such a good sense of humor with this. He even used to talk about it. He said, when you become who you are, you realize that you were in what he would call the causal dimension. We invent this life. We're inventing it right now. The mind is creating everything we're seeing. It's projecting it. From this causal dimension, he said, if you go back there, find out who you are, and you want ice cream, then you'll get the ice cream. If you want to get nothingness, you'll get nothingness. So he said, me being the fathead that I was, I asked for nothingness, and that's what I got. So he said, if I'd have known what was going to happen, I wouldn't have done that. So, but he would also caution us to say that the way to know that if your realization is real rather than a trick of your mind, because you'll know that you've always been there and that it's not what you thought it was going to be. It's never what you think it's going to be. If you get what you think, then you've probably never gotten out of the inside of your head. Yeah, it becomes strange too. What can happen to you in different senses? I've seen a lot of guys who've come back from realization and who have been very turned almost boring because they didn't have anything that they really wanted to do much anymore. I came back and was exactly the opposite. I was very fear-based before realization, very inhibited. So I was very scared to do anything. I didn't want to put myself on the line. I wanted to stay in my head where everything was safe, not have to get out and be responsible for anything. So after realization, I had no more fear in that sense. So all of a sudden, there was all these things that I had wanted to do, that now I could do it because I didn't care. It also lit up the reasoning parts of myself. I'd been very feeling-based, meaning that everything that I made decisions was based on like and don't like. I all of a sudden realized that there was this whole world of reason, that you could actually think things through. This became very adventuresome to me. It was like, oh my gosh, you can actually think about things and come to logical conclusions. I became very interested in writing at that point, because to me, writing became a way to try to reasonably talk about this work to other people, where before that, I had never been able to keep logical thoughts in a string very much. It was, like I said, just like or don't like. Just do what you want to do, and don't do what you don't want to do, and don't have to think about it. I found that trying to write essays was a very good discipline in this. My friend Sean was exactly the opposite. He was so very meticulously reasonable that he used to laugh at me for looking reading Rumi after he had his experience, he started spouting poetry. So it's funny how the paradoxes come about with this. He would sit and just have quatrains just come flowing out of him. Just phenomenal. Does anybody have a question, or would Lynn like to say something? We've just got a few minutes here.
All right, yes, and we can actually go on longer if you feel like it. We have actually until 8 o'clock Eastern time, or 8 o'clock our time, Mountain time, which is 10 o'clock Eastern time. So, but you know, I don't want to wear you out either, or take advantage of you. but one of the questions that I had was so much of the time the people that I know that are spiritual seekers are also very involved in worrying about the suffering in the world, and looking out into the world and saying, you know, we need to do something about you know, all these poor people that are suffering so deeply. You know, they're starving, or they're sick, or there's disease, or terrible governments, and I'm suffering about those things because I'm looking at those things and they're upsetting me, and I'm feeling, you know, terribly sad about everything. And I know that a lot of times people get involved in this work of trying to awaken, and they get caught up in the whole idea of somehow or the other somebody done somebody wrong, something bad is happening to me and to other people. And so the question that I'm asking you is, you know, first off, you know, how do you look at suffering? That's something people always ask me about. Well, what about the starving children? So, you know, that's something I'm interested in. You know, how do you see those things? And, you know, do you take them personally, or do you not, or do you, I'm not going to put words in your mouth. You tell me. So here's the mic back.
That's a pretty good question, Lynn, and I don't want to, I hope I'm not, yeah, that made very good sense. I don't want to step on anybody's toes here, but I came back and see the world as an illusion, as a mind projection, and that it's hard to talk about this because if you see things from that position, you see that there's actually nothing wrong. It looks like there's something wrong from the position of illusion and duality. And sure, there's a lot of pain and suffering in the world, but there's actually nobody suffering. The illusion is that there's individual things. And if there's individual things, then these things start bothering each other. But there are no individual things. It's all a play. Now, and from a certain sense, if we have to play a character in this play, then yeah, it seems like we're having a hard time with it. I had a brother who was had a very hard time of it. He passed on a few years ago, and I thought, you know, I'm glad that he finally got out, in a sense, and that maybe next time if he has to come back through this, he'll get a better script. But it's all an illusion, where we're all playing characters. And that's one way of looking at it. It's just like the Shakespeare, you know, the whole world's a stage and we're playing characters. I saw this in dreams before I understood it, in that I would find myself sitting in the audience watching the dreams and watching the play going on, and then my identification would switch from the guy in the audience up to a character. when this started happening in my dreams, it started happening more in the real world. I could see the identification of awareness jump from one dream character to another in the dreams. It's the same thing here. You can sometimes even get a glimpse of this, about how it can work on a very simple level. I would be sitting sometimes in an audience at a lecture or a movie, and if you sit next to somebody and you try to get a feeling sense of that person who's sitting next to you with a quiet mind and use developed feeling, you can feel that person. And you can feel what's going on with that person, and all of a sudden it's like, the way you can tell is it's all of a sudden you have, like, there's different furniture in the room than there usually is. So you are being able to pick up on that other person. Now, if that's happening, you can see that there's only one mind. It just becomes individualized because of the play. Rose had a system of trying to describe this. He said that the absolute being oneness has no other. But once it wants to see itself, which the first springing out would be wanting to know itself through love, then things take on duality in mind. And once the mind springs forth, then, oh my gosh, then what have you got? Well, here it is, this big mess. And how do we get out of this mess? He thought that there was a definite pattern to it. Did you have to get back from the mess that's here by going inside, not by trying to change things? He thought that we were being very arrogant by thinking that we can actually change anything going on in the world. And he thought we could also had to be very careful about trying to change people around us, because he thought that a person, you might not know what their lessons are. He used to say that if you're in a blind alley, how can you help somebody else get out of their blind alley? Unless you can see the whole problem, then it's hard to help somebody. He said that the best thing we can do with our energy is not to try and heal people's faults, but to try to show them how to get out of the illusion. He went through a period in his life when he could heal people. He said it was just an accident that he discovered in a group that he could see the sickness in a person, and he could walk over with his hand and pull it out of them and just heal them instantly like that. But he said he had to stop it because it became a show. People were coming to see him just because they wanted to get healed and they wanted to see the circus. And so he said he had to stop it because he didn't want people coming for that reason. And he said he also noticed it would be easy to get an ego about that. That, you know, oh, I'm a healer, so I'm going to, you know, start healing people. And he said he noticed that it was a downturning of energy, he said, because the person will go right back out and do what they did before in order to get sick again. Nothing really changed. So he said that the only thing that we can really heal is the illusion that of what we are. He said, the only thing I can do is burst bubbles. He said, I'm pretty good at it. I can pop bubbles. And that's just your illusion that you're a person and that there's a world and you're a thing in a world of other things. Bursting that bubble is the only thing he thought he could help people really with. He would try to help other people in terms of their suffering just because of the way he was. He was a very good hypnotist, and he could help people stop smoking and things along that line. Being a feeling person, I noticed, pick up on something. He taught hypnosis to us. He was really good at it. He could hypnotize people just by walking up to them. But he said that hypnotism, if you can learn how to hypnotize and learn what it means to be hypnotized, you can skip over a heck of a lot of ego bull and not have to go through a lot of learning processes. There's a fellow up in Oregon called Roy Masters who runs he calls it a Christian group now, but I've always found him real valuable, and Rose did too. But he started out as a hypnotist, and he said he noticed that the problem with people who came to him wasn't that they needed to be hypnotized, It was that they needed to be unhypnotized. They had beliefs that were making them sick. So he thought that the way to do this was unhypnotize people. Rose thought that if you can see how hypnosis works in you, you can see how this is affecting you, how auto-hypnosis keeps you trapped, and you can skip over a lot of work. I found this to be the case. And when I talked about the self-love, the hypnosis that I had, I was trapped in, had to be broken. And the hypnosis had to be done. You know, somebody put unlearning, not learning up here. That's exactly it. Like Rose said, you do not learn, you become. But you become that which you already are. That's a paradox. And it's not a cop-out. Some people will say, oh, yes, we already are what we become. There's nothing to do. But there is. It's unhypnotizing yourself from yourself. There can be a lot of work involved. I mean, we spent the time from when we were a kid all the way up till we get into this work hypnotizing ourselves. So it could take a lot of work to create the, you might call it the tension that will finally force you out of your emotional love for yourself. It is the paradox all the way. If you take the mind to its farthest point that you can take it, that as far a point as the mind can go, you run into paradox. That's where it finally breaks down. And it comes back into that. And somebody else put contrast up here. That's a very good way of putting it. My friend who's here in Fruta, Art Tickner, has some good books out. He was very instrumental in helping me, in confronting me by always pointing out the opposites to whatever I was thinking. If I was thinking one thing and believing in it, he would point that opposite out to me and saying that's just as valid. And it caused my mind to be able to do that. If you can work your way up through the opposite, sooner or later you're going to get to paradox and you're going to go as far as you can go. After that, thinking will not take you. You're going to have to go on intuition, on developed feeling. You know, thinking, Rose used to say you run the mind up a rat hole. And that's what you've got to do to it until it just breaks down. It's a funny thing. When I was a kid, it was before puberty. Before puberty, I had no problems. I think we resolved things pretty well before that as a kid. But I was sitting watching a TV show about the Nile, and there's the White Nile and the Blue Nile that come together to form the Nile. Something in my head grabbed a hold of that and turned it into the basic duality. And I thought to myself, there is no way that duality can exist. There is a oneness, and the problem is, how can we possibly have gotten lost in duality? This took me into what I thought at the time was a night terror, because the mind could not handle it for a 10-year-old kid. And it wasn't until 40 years later that I understood what had happened. But I had taken the mind as far through duality as it can. I've heard people say that if you can take the duality back in your own mind until you reach whatever your ultimate pair of opposites, what you're left with, is the destruction of the mind, and you can take yourself beyond. Yes, beyond all symbols. I see somebody put up there. That's a good one. People love to get lost in symbols. There's a Christian teacher. She was a nun for a long time. She's wrote some very good books on no self. Her name's Bernadette Roberts, a woman out in California, and she talks about how one of the traps that people in New Age disciplines can fall into is the trap of the archetypes. We can lapse off into a trap of the archetypes. We can become a teacher, a wise man, a goddess. And in those archetypes, it's very easy to get lost into that. It really pumps up the ego. it can be very hard to break the hold on that. We feel very powerful when we get into that. I found that for much of my life, I had been lost in an archetype inside my head of what's called the puer eternus. It's called Latin for the eternal boy. This is the innocent, non-responsible 6-year-old inside of us. Anytime life would get to be too hard, I'd just run away and go camping. I spent most of my adult life in what they call provisional living, living out of a backpack. And one of the ways I could get, I had to get out of that was to take on a certain responsibility, to put my butt on the line, so to speak. Doing that, being around Richard Rose, he really pummeled me on that one. He saw that I was another name for it is to be a Dharma bum. And being very fear-based, I found that I was naturally attracted to this strong guru figure, so I wanted to live on his ashram because I felt safe there. He would keep the boogeyman at bay. You know, if I could live around the enlightened man. So he knew that, and he knew that I was using him as a way to not face life, not face putting myself out there. So in one sense, him kicking me off the farm forced me to go out into life. One way that got started was I was noticing here with Phil with the watercolors that his wife does here. I got started in the dream work and with the being able to look inside and get around my ego without having it to confront it or turn it into just playing games with itself was through artwork. And it happened because I was working in a fly shop in Hot Sulphur Springs, and I was bored, and I was taking pieces of charcoal out of the wood stove, and I started drawing on paper with them. And I noticed that I was drawing pretty good stuff, and I got fascinated with it. And I thought, I bet I could do this to find out what my unconscious mind is trying to tell me about what I need to see about myself. I started taking a mirror and would set a mirror on the table and I would draw self-portraits of myself. And I noticed every time I would draw one, it would be a different person. But I was looking at the same guy. I was seeing sides of myself. We might think that we're a nice person, we're very spiritual, and I was drawing guys who looked like they were going to beat you to death with a golf club. Now, how did this happen? Where was that guy? Where did he come from? It showed me that maybe there's a way through artwork that I can see myself and see the who more this Bob character is so that I can stop letting him fool me all the time. I became trying to draw dreams and trying to draw the dreams out. I had a whole series of dreams of the intuition coming out, the feminine side of myself, as a lady coming out of the lake. And I would have to meet this woman on the shore of the lake. I noticed that I was going back home in the dreams after meeting this woman, and I was trying to wash my clothes really quick before my real earthly mother caught me, because she didn't want me to go meet the woman at the lake. This is the materialistic side of ourselves trying to keep us away from this. So I had to sneak down there, to sneak to the feminine side. The woman in the lake told me that I would have to come see her 1,000 times before she would come out of the unconscious and teach me more about myself. She wanted a commitment. She wasn't just going to play around with me. But the sneaking up on the ego, like you're saying, yes, the artwork helped a lot. I would draw out these dreams, would draw out what I was seeing, and would draw symbols of other people. I had a friend who had gotten sober about the same time I did, and she was like myself on death's door when we finally sobered up. I used to have dreams that I saw her being rescued from a river before she fell over the rocks and was crashed. She was pulled up into the clouds. To me, this was a symbol of something in her unconscious mind saved her. I could draw it out. So for me, artwork was a way of sneaking around myself to be able to let these things through without the materialistic ego shutting them down. This is a very tricky business. There's a couple of guys that are in our Denver group that have very astute business egos from being very successful in life. These egos will not let anything come through that's not qualified. It's very hard for them to get their way around this. I think the more successful we are in life, the harder it can be for us. I think Jim Burns used to say that nothing succeeds like failure in this work. He says until you completely fail, you won't be able to find yourself. And that's how it was for me. I could bounce from teacher to teacher without it phasing me. But until I could completely fall on my face and fail and not be able to hide it, then it would have an effect. It would break the egos down. Sometimes it would be to the point of just weeping. I used to wonder about where the weeping came from. I had to go through quite a bit of this, which I think was small egos dying off. Rose used to say that we need to kill the egos off in a somewhat correct order, or else we'll be useless. We might not have our ability to function afterwards. And the egos were dying off in me for several years. I would come home at night and think, I'm going to meditate. I'm going to sit here on my gomden on the rug and go into my meditation. As soon as I would sit down and look within, I would start weeping. And I thought, this is crazy. I can't meditate. All I'm going to do is weep. I didn't know why this was happening. And I found out what it was just all this ego material was coming out. And it was just pouring out. Somebody said, you're probably losing egos you don't even know you have. And that was a good bit of it there. These things would come pouring out. And the final realization was at the end of the weeping that became so horrendous that it knocked me right out the window. Yes, we're... What you're saying here is, Lynn, is do you have any idea why we are here? You know, I think that's a personal thing, and I think, yes, you can find out why you're here. You can find out why you're here, and you can find out what it is you need to do. Now, that's a funny one, because it could be hidden from us. Jim Burns, this fellow I talk about who was enlightened, he was enlightened when he was a teenager, when he was 16 years old. And then spent 30 years in mental institutions. Now, he said that when he went to the other side and went to his other self, he said he had visions. And he said his higher self appeared to him as himself and told him why he was here and why he had to go back. And he said, I don't want to go back there. That is craziness back there. I don't want to go back into that world. But then he knew on the other side why he had to come back. So he agreed to it, but he says when he would come back here, he couldn't have access to that. Because I've seen this happen time and time again in my life. If I had any idea what was up ahead, I wouldn't agree to it. I wouldn't do it. So I think we keep it from ourselves. I think that in certain instances, you may be able to find out why you're here, but I think we have to keep it away from ourselves or we'll cop out. Rose used to say too that it's a lot of like karma. He thought that karma had to be expended, and it is better to let your karma burn out rather than keep putting it on the credit card. He said most people keep pushing it back. They don't want to have anything to do with it. They want to keep distracted. And you know that's a tricky one. We're talking about paradoxes here, so it's hard to talk about this in language and to tell somebody, well, you're here because you need to know why you keep falling for the trick. Why do you keep falling for the idea that you're a thing? Why does that happen? Or maybe you come back here because you want to help somebody. You've got people you want to help. Now that's a paradox, because if you see that there's nobody to be helped, why would you come here? But look around. The paradox is in front of us. It's here and it's not here. Rose used to say that if non-action is valid, then action is just as valid. So there's no reason not to do things any more than there's a reason to do things. In the end, it's all the same. So why not act? I've always thought that you can use non-action or peace as a cop-out. I see that action is just as valid, so why not act? I think until you're free, you really can't act in a very good way, because you're going to be acting from experience. You won't be able to act in a sense of spontaneity. You'll have too many little judgments back there that aren't going to allow you to act. In other words, how would you tell a friend of yours something they might need to hear if you've got a belief system that won't allow that? Yeah, I would say, you know, Rose used to say, you're saying that isn't awakening going to eventually happen? Sure, everything's happened. Everything will happen, and everything's happening right now. So what's the point in even trying to get awakened? It's going to happen. Well, one reason is if you're miserable, then maybe you're going to want to do something about that. And if you see people around you are miserable, maybe you're going to want to, you know, burst the bubble that of their misery. And what can you do? That's what I'm saying about it. There's nothing wrong with acting. I don't think you can really get it wrong, but I think you can stay deluded. You know, you can definitely... stay deluded in this, and maybe it's going to eventually happen sooner or later. But do you have time to keep going through this? He said that people ask him, well, if everything's already happened, and if there's nothing but the absolute, why do you do what you do? Why do you try to help people? Why are you a teacher? Or why do you write books? What's the point? And he said, if I thought everybody ended up in the same kettle of fish, I wouldn't do this. He said he thought that you could end up after this life in a worse or a better place. So if you're going to keep doing that and keep bouncing around from one bardo, he would call them, as in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, if you're going to go from one bardo to another, why not stop it now? So he was very much... He also said that it was an obsession. He said that I'm obsessed with it. He said that it's not, you know, a done deal. You don't have to teach. He said, I just do it because I'm obsessed with it. He also did it because he made a promise. When he was at the time of World War II, he got out of the draft and snuck around because he wanted to be he was looking for the truth. He didn't want to end up in the army and getting killed before he found it. So he stayed out, but his older brother went into the army and died. And Rose said that he saw that his brother had made a sacrifice for him so that he could still look for the truth while his brother paid the price for that. So he said he promised his brother that he would find something, and if he did find something, he'd help other people to find it. He was that kind of guy, you know. If he made a promise, he stuck to it. He used to tell us, you know, that one of the best things you can do for yourself is always do what you say. If you say you're going to do something, finish it. So he made a promise to his brother that he would teach. He also used to tell us that keep at this until you're there. He said, don't drop the ball on the 5-yard line, you know, and take it over. You know, so this, I think some of you might have noticed this too, if you've gotten into this work and if you've gotten serious about it, that if you make a move and a commitment to find out who you really are, to find the truth, Rose would call them forces of adversity. You can call it the ego, the materialistic animal self, whatever the resistance is, it will make a counter move. So the harder you try, the harder the resistance will come. So we have to be pretty adamant about this so we can get stopped pretty quick. There's always a counter move. Maurice Nicole used to tell people, he said that people get into this work and they think that as they go along, it gets easier. And he said, no, it gets harder. So it's different now. This guy, Roy Rudy, is the same age as I am, and he's going to enjoy what time is left on the vacation of a dream. Yeah, it's funny. Rose used to say that there is no such thing as pleasure or pain. That pleasure or pain are dualistic concepts in the mind. But until you come to that realization, you're going to be forced in between those opposites. You can always be trying to balance the pain out with pleasure, and by seeking pleasure you will generate pain. I found out that in the depths of alcoholism, that when I started drinking, it was 90% fun and 10% pain. By the time I got to the end of it, it had reversed, and it was 90% pain, 10% pleasure, and I was miserable. And that's not talking about miserable in a theoretical sense. I was sick crawling around in the gutter miserable. So that was incentive to find my way out of this. You know, I don't mention the word God. Somebody asked a question. Can you speak to that? I don't try to use words that have been burned up. You know, too many things like love, God, peace, oneness. I find that these things get so used that they become meaningless. I think that you are God. Each one of us is God. You are the source. If you find your way back, you will find that there is no other God but you, and that you create yourself, and you are everything. Now, till you know that, like Ramana Maharshi said, then you're going to have to accept the existence of the Lord until you know your God. You're going to have to accept that. I can get into this in another way of speaking, is that when I was in the depths of the alcoholism, I got to the point where I thought I was dying. I was in the rehab, the ARC, Alcohol Recovery Center in Boulder, Colorado. I was laying on a bed, and I was very, very drunk, and I had an alcoholic seizure, and my heart stopped. And I thought I was dying, and it wasn't theoretical. I really thought, this is it, I'm dead. My heart stopped, and I became paralyzed. And I gave up, but you can't give up. You can't willfully surrender. It has to be taken from you. I thought I was dead, so the survival ego, the last one we have, finally let go. And when that happened, something healed me. And when it healed me, what I realized was that I had agreed to accept the higher power. I agreed that there was something bigger than my ego. Up until that point, I thought my ego was God. And that my decisions made for my rational ego was it. I realized at that point that there was something higher than me. And it had healed me. And that showed me that there is something to go for. There is a spiritual part of me. How do I get back to that? It gave me a faith in the path. And it showed me that my ego was not the ultimate. That it was something which had caused all my problems, and the higher part of me had to come through and fix things. And that couldn't happen until I was emptied or dead. Now, this was a long time before I even met Richard Rose. By the time I met him, I knew that there was a path. It's just that I was still an individual looking. I had faith. But I hadn't come to the point where I knew I wasn't a thing. Exactly. A concept of God is useful. Like, you have to have the ability to say, okay, there's something bigger than me. There is a higher power. There is a God. You can't think that you're an ego or that you're an accident. Because then you will never give up. You will never allow the higher part of yourself to come in there. It just won't happen. This is a paradox. I mean, when I got to to the other side of myself and realize I had always been there, I realized that this poor little guy was just flailing, and it was pretty much almost like a blessed act of grace that anything finally came to change that. I think knowing there's a higher power also makes you receptive to grace. We have to become to where we'll allow grace to come in. Rose used to say that you have to allow. You have to allow yourself to have grace come in. And then he would joke about it and said, but I don't want you guys to be allowing yourselves to go out and get drunk. there is some discrimination in this. You know, there were some of the guys in the early group who used to think there was nothing wrong with getting drunk because Jesus drank wine. And our ability to rationalize is just amazing. How we can fool ourselves. Yes, once grace comes through, if you've gotten to the point where grace can visit you, it's overwhelming. It is. We were talking a while back about Rumi's talks about the friend. And I thought that was a very good way to talk about it. He says that everything is worth sacrificing for a visit from the friend. And if grace or the friend comes through, I used to get the feeling that when it happened, I would say to myself, I'm back. It was that feeling. It was like I had been lost, wandering around in the mind realm, and all of a sudden, I'm back. I'm back here in myself again. I've been lost. Those periods of falling asleep and waking up and falling asleep happened all my life until the final loss of individuality. But that feeling is a good thing for the intuition to latch onto, because then you can see that there's something, a bigger part of you. That's where that developed feeling or intuition can come in. It's good that somebody said earlier, Rose used to say that, those Zen koans too. He was really big on the koans because he thought we had to get to that paradox, and a koan will eventually take you there. If you chew on a paradox, I mean a koan, long enough, you'll end up there. And that one is, what was your original face? Or one that got me was, what was your face before your parents were born? And you know, what was I? And that was, if you take that far enough, in a real sense, you will find yourself as the part of yourself which does not do, which is already is. It doesn't believe it can do. That part of us is right there. Rose used to say, nothing moves. Which is pretty much the same thing. Yes, if anybody else has got any questions, wants to, or if Lynn has anything to say, they can go ahead and pop their little hand up here.
I'm just really loving listening to everything that you're saying, your answers to our questions. Most of the people that are here, well, I can't say most of the people, I'd say everybody who is here really dedicated to just awakening and to knowing our true selves. And so it's just such a pleasure to have someone come in who is so clear. And I don't know about y'all, but I'm really pleased with the clarity of your thinking. And I would really like to invite you at any time to come back. There are many of us who teach here on a regular basis. That was one of the things I was wondering about with you, if you did any kind of teaching at all. And I'm glad to hear that you do, because that is I think most of us are pretty much dedicated to sharing our gift, whatever it may be. And so I'm just thrilled to hear that you have the same kind of thought. I wanted to thank you so much for being here and invite you back at any time. I think you feel like part of our family. I mean, I feel like you're one of us. And I know that's probably sounds goofy, but it doesn't matter to me either. You feel like family. And I would like to encourage anyone to get that book. I've been reading that book, and I swear to you, I love it. I love to fish. I love to camp. You know, I live here in Colorado most of my life. And so you just seem like a very kindred person. But I'm going to give you back the mic. We have about 5 more minutes. And anything that you would like to leave us with, please feel free to do so. So, Bob, thank you again, and the mic is all yours.
Well, thank you, Lynn. I'm glad to come do this. I do most of the teaching I do through the TAT Foundation. I have ever since I met Rose. And there's some other good teachers, too, that are in that. We have our meetings, and we have our little group in Denver. We meet right currently every other Tuesday at the library, which is down near Denver City Park. All right, I can put some notices up on that. And the TAT Foundation is having a meeting in about 2 weeks. There's some really good people in that. There's other teachers that studied with Rose for quite a bit, really great people. And it's a very good thing. If you can go to a TAT meeting, you'll meet people from all over the country and from Ireland. We've got a group in Ireland. We've got groups on the West Coast, East Coast, that you can get in touch with some of these people. I wanted to say something too about the camping and hiking and being out by myself. Jim Burns used to say that it takes a lot of time to rebuild the bridge between the inner self and the outer self. And you have to buy that time somehow. For me, it was getting away from distractions, getting away from phones and social interaction. And I used to go sit in the desert by myself. And people would say, oh, you just love nature. And I have to clarify that and say that, well, yes, but that's not why I did it. I did it because when I'm out there, nature without distractions is a neutral ground. It allows you to have a clear head. You're not under the gun. Rose advised us to do something he called isolations, which people now call them solitary retreats. And it's very important, I think, nowadays, especially with all the technology. But if in any way you can get away from social interactions and your phone and a computer and sit in the quiet for even a few days, there was always an incredible change. I found it backpacking. I found on the second or third day of backpacking that not only did the outer world go quiet, but I noticed my inner world went quiet. And I figured, what is that? Well, why is this happening? And it became a place to work. That inner quiet was somewhere I could work on trying to get a handle on Bob. I called it stalking myself. I hunted and fished when I was a kid, so to me this was like, if you're going to know a deer and you're going to hunt deer, you have to be able to think like a deer and know what they're going to do. So I had to figure out who Bob was and what he was doing so that I could find out how not to let my ego keep tricking me all the time into thinking that I was seeing it when I was just the ego spinning around. This made sense to me, and it's only been recent years that I've been able to talk about it. Yes, I liked Castaneda quite a bit. I wanted to meet Don Juan really bad back in those days. But it helped a lot to be out by myself. And it also helped me to see the different sides of myself. I saw that I had a social ego when I was in society, and after a few days out in the desert without anybody around, that would die away and disappear. And I thought, well, if that social ego has disappeared, that's not me. But when I go into society, I think it's me, it feels like it, and there it comes back. So how does that work? It gave me a little bit of a wedge, a working point to look at through that, seeing how the social self comes back into gear and disappears again. Rose found this trick out by spending winters by himself on his farm. And he saw the value in that. And I saw it from taking trips out into the desert. So there's a lot of different things we can do. A lot of it has to do with what are you like? What do you have to do? If you're a feeling person, how can you use that? If you're a thinking person, how can you use that? Find out what you're like and then use it against yourself. I'd like to thank everybody for coming on tonight and for asking the questions on here. This was very interesting and it was really wonderful to have met Phil here and to have met all of you people. And we definitely should stay in touch and stay in touch through your group and you guys get in touch with Tat too. And thanks a lot for having me.
All right. Thank you again, Bob Ferguson. Thank you so much for being here. And wow, what a wonderful couple of hours. This has just been great. And yes, we would love it if you would come and share and teach. Now you see how easy it is. Thank God you have Phil to help you out with getting set up, because that's always the hardest thing for people is getting set up to be here. So you already got the course, the crash course, so it is wonderful. Again, thank you so much, Bob Ferguson.